The headlines: the U.S. restores a sanctions waiver to Iran, canceled by former President Donald Trump after he withdrew from the 2015 agreement. China advising the U.S. to be more flexible towards North Korea as it votes down Washington's proposed statements against Pyongyang's missile launches at the Security Council. Thank you for joining us. My name is Kisumi Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Now, the United States has restored a number of sanctions waivers on the 2015 Iran deal, also known as the JCPOA. Media cited a U.S. State Department report as saying that the step is meant to facilitate the Vienna talks on the revival of the agreement. The exemptions allow foreign companies to resume cooperation with Iran on its nuclear projects. The waivers are part of the 2015 accord. They were canceled by former U.S. President Donald Trump after he withdrew from the agreement in 2018, and reimposed anti-Iran sanctions. Iran and the remaining signatories to the JCPOA are set to resume talks in Vienna. Iran says an agreement hinges on the removal of U.S. sanctions and guarantees that Washington will not pull out of the deal again. Author and journalist Robert Fontina says the latest move by the U.S. To waive some sanctions on Iran shows that Washington is making concessions. However, he adds that it is a matter of time whether the U.S. keeps its commitments.
This waiver of sanctions, which allows the several other countries to work with nuclear projects, is a very positive step. It may signal that the JCPOA could possibly be a resurrection at this time, although there is still a major issue of Iran needing, rightly, an assurance that the U.S. won't arbitrarily withdraw from it again. This waiver will indicate that the U.S. is willing to make some concessions, but the major point, as you mentioned, is that the government of the United States cannot be trusted. It has proven that repeatedly in the context of Iran, not only in JCPOA, but throughout recent history. So there still needs to, this will not be enough. There needs to be some guarantee, and I can't see what that would be. I had the approval of the United Nations, and yet the U.S. still violated it. But this is a step, a very positive step, one that is surprising, but Joe Biden is in a situation right now where his approval rating is very low. He's threatening war with Russia. He needs some kind of win. And so a return to JCPOA and the reestablishment of that agreement would give him a win. But whether or not he'll be able to achieve it because of the U.S.'s very poor track record of keeping its commitments remains to be seen.
Now, France says it will provide military support to the United Arab Emirates to help it protect its airspace against any intrusion. Now, that is amid Yemeni retaliatory airstrikes on the Emirates. French Defense Minister Florence Parly says her country is also helping the UAE with aerial surveillance. Earlier, the United States also announced the deployment of a warship and fighter planes to help the UAE counter the Yemeni attacks. Yemen's armed forces have launched a volley of drone and missile strikes on the Emirates. The Yemeni army says it will continue its campaign as long as the UAE keeps targeting the people of Yemen as part of the Saudi-led war on the country. The aggression has killed hundreds of thousands of Yemenis and displaced millions of others since 2015. Earlier, we were joined by Firas Al-Najim from a group called Canadian Defenders for Human Rights. He believes that the retaliatory Yemeni drone and missile strikes against Saudi Arabia and the UAE show the aggressors have miserably failed their plots.
The Yemenis are very much united, and the leadership there is very strong and very wise. And you know, we got the logistical support of the French, the U.S., and the British, and they cannot win any battles inside Yemen. They have failed miserably in every battlefield inside Yemen. And Yemen has, after 7 years, worst humanitarian crisis in the world, under a major blockade and bombardment 24/7, 7 days a week. And they were able now to fly drones and advance their technology and learn how to build their own planes that fly to the UAE and be able to defeat all these radars and all these different systems that they have supposedly to protect them from these countries. They've been purchasing weapons from the whole world, including Canada, unfortunately. And these countries here in the West that preach human rights all day and night, they know that they're selling arms to the worst human rights violating regimes such as Saudi Arabia, and they failed.
Moving on, China is urging more flexibility from the United States to reduce tensions with North Korea over its nuclear and ballistic missile program.
The key in solving this issue is already in the hands of the United States. U.S. is a direct party to the Korean Peninsula issue. If they do want to see some new breakthrough, they should show more sincerity and flexibility.
The Chinese envoy says the U.S. should come up with the more attractive and practical actions to address North Korea's concerns. Zhang warns Washington to avoid what he calls a vicious circle of confrontation, condemnation, and sanctions against Pyongyang. His comments came ahead of a closed-door UN Security Council meeting on North Korea's latest ballistic missile tests. At that meeting, the U.S. put forward a joint statement condemning Pyongyang's ceasefirings, but seven members refused to sign it. Meanwhile, the U.S. ambassador to the UN says Washington is ready to sit down for talks with Pyongyang without preconditions. Andrew Leung, an independent China specialist, has joined us from Hong Kong to talk about the United States policy on North Korea. He believes that in order for the outstanding issues to be resolved, Washington needs to change its attitude rather than strategy towards Pyongyang.
North Korea has been learning from the all these parties, six-party talks, the Trump administration's so-called olive branch, all this came to nothing because the United States hasn't changed its kind of stance. In fact, what it has left the United States is just an attitude rather than a strategy. Now, the United States should understand that what the North Korea is trying to achieve is not to attack other people because this economy is so weak, and what it wants is to shore up the legitimacy of its regime, by developing its economy. But with all the sanctions and also the threat of force, the North Korea will feel increasingly being threatened. So the message being sent by Beijing is that the United States should really rethink its engagement strategy with North Korea, not try to force the North Korean to give up everything, but also be able to give some concessions in return, doing a step-by-step kind of approach.
Meanwhile, British households have been hit by the news of higher energy bills, interest rates, and inflation. The government is trying to downplay its role in making Britain significantly poorer, but the opposition is having none of it. Bianca Rahimi reports from London.
Come April, many Britons will have to choose between heating and eating. Everything from bus fares to mortgages are going to cost more. Interest rates have gone up twice in 7 weeks, and three more hikes are on the horizon as the central bank tries to tackle the situation. The opposition members of parliament are livid, saying the government is incompetent.
He doesn't like it, Mr. Speaker. When children in my constituency go to bed with no food in their tummies, with no heat in their homes, what does he really think is the honourable position of a Chancellor who has just allowed one of his policies directly to be taken in fraud, £4.3 billion of fraud under his watch? Any other Chancellor that I've known would come to the House today to resign.
This week, millions learnt that their gas and electricity bills are going to jump 54%. The government says there's nothing it can do with energy prices going up worldwide.
I don't believe them at all. You know, I'm sure they know, you know, and this is just to put people more in poverty, you know. And it's not right, it's not fair, you know. People working very hard.
When you look at the price of things now, everything going up higher than it was. And that's why so many people on the street, living on the street, because they can't afford to eat or drink.
Oh, I feel like it's government responsible to support people who are in this horrible situation. Because I had a problem this year myself. I couldn't find an apartment because the prices went up crazy twice.
Also causing inflation to rise is supply chain issues, higher import taxes and wages increasing. Brexit, the pandemic and a global energy crisis, a perfect storm for Britain, now in the grips of its worst economic slump in 300 years. But who will have to pay for it all?
On April 1st, the cost of living will be going up £3,000 a year for each household. On the very same day, British politicians will be getting a £2,000 a year pay rise. From this, it is clear that those that are on top of the pile have their bills covered, and it's those on the breadline that will be picking up those bills. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Now, the EU records a sharp increase in applications from refugees seeking asylum. Rights groups decry moves by the bloc leaders to arm 10,000 border guards to keep refugees out. Miriam Hughes reports from Brussels.
The European Union Agency for Asylum, EUAA, says new refugee applications in the 27-country bloc are at a five-year high, mainly being submitted by Afghans and Syrians. On Wednesday, 19 refugees were found dead on the border between Turkey and EU nation Greece. It's believed they died from hypothermia. The European Commission claims it's trying to gather further information. EU Home Affairs ministers have been meeting to try and advance the bloc's new refugee policy, known as the Migration Pact.
The strategy of all or nothing up to now has actually given us nothing, and this is not good for member states or the European Union. We want to breathe new life into the EU Migration Pact.
When it comes to the refugee crisis, civil society organizations and many EU lawmakers make the point that the West never learns from its mistakes. They are expressing concern that stoking tensions with Russia over Ukraine has the potential to create a new refugee crisis. It's suggested war hawks in the US and NATO don't give a damn about the millions of people who have been displaced through military intervention in countries such as Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Yemen, and Libya. As the EU's Poland and Lithuania construct a new wall along their borders with Belarus, the European Commission is promising billions of euro to expand and arm the bloc's border agency, Frontex.
Frontex is by far the biggest agency we ever had. And we are setting it up right now, and it's huge. It's going to have 10,000 armed people at our external borders.
The EU's own data shows 100,000 children and teenagers go missing in the bloc every year. Most of those are refugees. Campaigners are calling for greater cooperation between police forces.
There need to be better information sharing platforms so we know exactly how many children are going missing and what are the actual risks that they face, because right now, nobody knows.
With EU nations refusing to take in refugees, and as billions are spent on keeping them out, rights groups are again asking, where are the bloc's much-trumpeted values? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Toronto becomes the second Canadian city where truckers line the streets to push for an end to mandated COVID vaccines. Dozens of tractors and pickup trucks rolled into Toronto's downtown on Friday. They plan to hold a protest at the weekend against mandatory COVID vaccines for cross-border truckers. Some are angry at the entire restrictions the government has enforced to fight the virus. They say Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has exceeded his authority and should leave power. The truckers in Toronto are part of a convoy called a Freedom Convoy, which has already reached the capital, Ottawa. Protesters there have shut down the center of the city for more than a week now. Ottawa police have promised to crack down on what they call an increasingly dangerous protest there. And the COVID-19 pandemic keeps taking its toll on the United States, with overall fatalities there now surpassing 900,000. According to the Johns Hopkins University, over 100,000 fatalities were just added since mid-December. Data shows new daily deaths are still rising, with an average of 2,400. A new wave of rising COVID cases is also taking place, with at least 18 states and Puerto Rico setting pandemic records for a second day. Health experts are now warning Americans about what they call an Omicron blizzard in the coming weeks. They say rising infections threaten hospitals, schools, and other sectors and could heavily impact daily lives. The U.S. has the largest death and case tallies in the world. Now that brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Islamic Revolution and New Islamic Civilization. In the name of God, Salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, we are in the 10 days done, the period marking the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979. The statement of the second phase of the Islamic Revolution, which was issued by the leader on the 40th anniversary of the victory of the revolution, was indeed the upper hand document of establishing the new Islamic civilization. among the oppressed nations, few stage a revolution, and among those which do so, few have managed to finish the job. In other words, among those few nations which have changed the ruling system, very few have successfully kept the ideals of revolution in the face of hostilities and plots. But the Islamic revolution of the Iranian nation was an exception in this regard. It has been the most popular revolution of not the 20th century, but several centuries. Therefore, it has boastfully insisted on its ideals despite 43 years of ceaseless hostility and conspiracy of enemies. The Islamic Revolution terminated the long history of decadence. Iran had been humiliated during various kingdoms, particularly the Qajarid and Pahlavi rules. Ayatollah Khamenei says on the backwardness of Iran during the Pahlavi regime, "Before the rule of Islam in this country, we were a backward nation in the full sense of it. We were dependent, politically backward, scientifically backward, socially backward, and isolated in the world of politics. Today, the progresses of the Islamic Republic have urged even our enemies to admit. Today, in the scientific ranking, in the technological ranking, in many modern sciences of the world, we are at the grade of advanced countries. The Islamic Ummah, with a strenuous and serious effort, can design the Islamic civilization of this era to set its foundations, to make it flourish and put it forward before the eyes of mankind." The leader of the Islamic Revolution, introducing the Islamic civilization, says, "In the new Islamic civilization, the spirituality stands beside material issues and ethics. Spirituality is beside the progress of material life." Ayatollah Khamenei further explains that the new Islamic civilization consists of two parts, namely, instrumental and real. The instrumental part includes the values that we consider as progress, such as sciences, inventions, industry, politics, economy, political and military might, international position, etc. The real part of the civilization consists of lifestyle and whatever shapes our life, like family, way of marriage, kind of house, type of clothing, consumption pattern, kinds of food, cuisine, entertainment, job and employment, way of conduct at work, behavior in university, school and the media, behavior with friends, enemies and foreigners. According to the Quran, material and spiritual growth will come to existence once the society and individuals move in the way of God. In view of this, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, introduced monotheism as the core of his mission. The knowing of prophethood, which comes after monotheism, also means knowing the Islamic unity and civilization. The Prophet founded the Islamic unity and civilization and fulfilled many social, cultural, political, and economic changes to set the ground for establishment of a glorious global civilization in a short period. Thus, the monotheistic Ummah and the Islamic civilization thereof are based on the rule of Allah. Ayatollah Khamenei, stressing this issue, maintains that the society based on monotheism will achieve all beliefs which the Islamic civilization brings about. According to verse 257 of chapter Baqarah of the Quran, "Allah is the guardian of the faithful, He brings them out of darkness into light. Thus, the reality of the Islamic civilization is to get distant from darkness and entering light. Ayatollah Khamenei says, "The world of Islam today is duty-bound to breathe the spirit in this world, like Islam itself and the Prophet himself, to create a new atmosphere, to open a new way. We call this phenomenon, which we are waiting for, as the new Islamic civilization. We should pursue the new Islamic civilization for mankind. This basically differs from what the powers are thinking and doing for mankind. It does not mean capturing lands. It does not mean transgressing upon the rights of nations. It does not mean imposing one's ethics and culture on other nations. It means to present the divine gift to nations so that nations, through their free will, through their choice, and through their distinguishing, choose the right way. The way towards which today the world powers have taken nations is a wrong and a straight way. This is our duty today." Dear friends, the victory of the Islamic Revolution and emergence of the Islamic Iran as a powerful country challenging the very existence of big powers has made it possible to found a new Islamic civilization. Ayatollah Khamenei says, "Unity is not a political and tactical move. It is rather a heartfelt belief and faith in the necessity of the unity of the Islamic Ummah. The first step in the unity of the Islamic Ummah is for the Muslim communities, governments, ethnicities, and denominations to refrain from aggressing on and striking one another to get united against the common enemy. And in the next steps, the Islamic countries should have synergy and make effort together in sciences, riches, security, and political power in order to reach the new Islamic civilization. The Islamic Revolution is marking its 43rd anniversary. Although the enemies of this revolution have incessantly schemed innumerable plots since the birth of this revolution to destroy it, it has stood tall in the world and kept inspiring new generations to withstand big powers with the hope in a bright future in which there would be no place for the global arrogance symbolized in the US and the fabricated Zionist regime of Israel."
Spotlight. Welcome to Spotlight. Israel has been using its vast support from the U.S. to find allies in the Middle East region. Days ago, Israeli President Isaac Herzog made his first visit to the UAE. The visit marks another step by the two sides to bolster ties despite concerns among regional countries. Well, Iran has raised the alarm about Israel's growing presence in the West Asian region, saying the regime poses a major threat to all regional countries. Bahrain also received the Israeli Minister of Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, in an official two-day visit. Bahrain was one of the regional states that normalized its relations with the Israeli regime via the Washington-mediated so-called Abraham Accords back in August 2020. Ever since, the island has been witnessing near daily popular protests against the deals, whose opponents say opens up the way for the Israeli regime's interference in the Persian Gulf region.
Some Arab countries have had clandestine relations with Israel for many years, despite claiming support for Palestinians and calling for the liberation of the occupied territories. But recently, these relations have become increasingly overt, and it seems they have nothing to be afraid of anymore to reveal their relations. In the latest developments, the Israeli regime's Minister of Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, visited Manama on Thursday and met with Bahrain's king and other high-ranking officials. During the visit, the two sides signed a security cooperation agreement with Bahrain, the first such deal between Israel and a Persian Gulf Arab country. Gantz claims the agreement takes the bilateral relations to new heights and will contribute to the security of both Manama and Tel Aviv and the stability of the region.
It was not only a normal reception, but number one, it is the first time that any Gulf state has signed a defense agreement with the Zionists, with the occupiers of Palestine. Number two, that he was taken to all military establishments, especially the Americans, to boast of the military strength of the regime, that it can rely on the support of America and Israel.
Bahrain's main opposition group, Al-Wefaq, slammed the move, saying any security or military agreement between the kingdom and Israel is unlawful and has no legitimacy. The group also blasted the visit by Gantz as crossing red lines. Analysts say not only political groups, but civil society groups in Bahrain consider Israel an enemy.
The people in Bahrain, with all their segments, whether opposition political societies that represent the popular majority, such as Al-Wefaq Society, and all civil society associations, consider Israel an enemy and reject any form of normalization with this enemy.
Palestinian resistance movement Hamas also strongly condemned the visit, saying the move emboldened the Israeli regime to commit more crimes. Israeli officials have made similar visits to a number of other Arab states, such as the United Arab Emirates, Sudan, and Morocco in the past couple of years, to normalize ties with them. Bahrain, along with the UAE, normalized relations with Israel in 2020 under the so-called Abraham Accords through agreements brokered by the United States of America. Morocco and Sudan later signed similar U.S.-backed deals with the Israeli regime. Palestinians view the deals as a stab in their back and a betrayal of their cause of liberating their lands from Israel's decades-long occupation, leaving them with no other option but to rely on their resistance to free their territories and establish their own independent government.
Joining us on Spotlight, we have activist and political analyst Leif Maarouf, joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. And journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier, joining us from Brussels. Let's start off with Mr. Maarouf in the Lebanese capital. Sir, it's great to have you with us. More Persian Gulf Arab governments. They're expanding ties with the Israelis, but are these actions further putting the security of the region at risk?
Well, if you really look at these agreements, they're not going to change any much in the what's on the ground. This is Bahrain hosting the American Central Command fleet, the largest naval base basically for the United States in the most of the region, and if not the world, outside the United States. And what are they going to bring with this treaty beyond open relations? These are relations that have been in existence between Bahrain and Qatar and the Emirates and the Saudis since the creation of the Zionist state, in the closed doors, behind the closed doors, and they financed against any revolutionary movements in the region, including the Arab Union movements led by Nasser, or the liberation movements in Syria and Lebanon and so forth. So nothing's really going to change, but the fact that now the Bahrainis population is going to be used as gun fodder for the Israeli, the Zionist colony, because in the next war, if Bahrain is involved in a war against Iran on the side of the Zionist colony, it is Bahrain that's going to be decimated in such war, and taking those beatings on behalf of the Zionists.
Elijah McNair, how do you view the repercussions of intelligence and military cooperation between the Israeli regime and the likes of the Bahrainis and the UAE? Does this undermine and threaten the security of the region? Just to recall, Iran's foreign minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian recently told his Emirati counterpart that the presence of Israel in the region poses a threat to all regional countries.
Thank you for having me. I think since Israel joined the CENTCOM in Central Europe, the relationship between the Israeli military and the US military has expanded and the bond is much stronger, which also justifies the relationship between the US and all the Arab and Gulf countries. Therefore, Israel used to be an abusive entity against its own population, and also plotting against Iran and the Axis of the Resistance and any other country that stands against the US hegemony of the Middle East. And now what happened, the Israelis have more ground to stand on in Bahrain, in the Emirates, and not surprisingly in Saudi Arabia, and they used to have in Egypt and Jordan. So the Israelis are expanding their presence. However, this is not going to change a lot of the Israeli performance, because there is already a rule of deterrence established between all the enemies of Israel and all the allies of Israel. I don't think there's much to be seen from the Israeli side in the future, apart from abusing of the wealth of the Gulf country that are very happy to welcome the Israelis. And also, there is a lot of similarity between what the Israelis are doing and what the Gulf countries are doing, particularly Bahrain in this case. So I think the Bahraini can learn a bit more from the Israelis, not only about security, but about how the cruel conditions of the prisoners in Israel, because we have exactly the same condition in Bahrain that were condemned by the US House Committee a few months ago, talking about the arbitrary detention about political prisoner, about the restriction of freedom, all these inhuman conditions of people who oppose the Bahrain regime and ask for their freedom of expression. There's a lot of similarity of that in Israel against the Palestinians. So I think they complete each other.
Laith Maruf, let's not overlook the U.S.'s role in these normalization deals and the expansion of ties. What is Washington pursuing here, both in terms of the Israeli interests and in terms of its own regional motives?
Well, the Americans and before them the British were always trying to create, manufacture a good Arab, a good house Arab that they can market to their population as acceptable. And at the same time, this is what finally the Gulf countries are trying to provide to the Americans, because for a long time these Gulf countries were providing also on behalf of American decision making and CIA decisions the example of the bad Arab that was put in Hollywood, of the terrorists, of the Osama bin Ladens, of the Baghdadis, which is another service. So right now the Saudis and the Bahrainis and the Emiratis and the Qataris, what they are delivering to the American empire in value is that creation of this new propaganda that the good Arab is the one that accepts the rule of Zionist colonists and American hegemony over our land, over our holy lands. That the good Arab is the one that rules Mecca and Medina, the holiest cities of Islam, but allows the American to come into this land, or allows the Israelis to occupy Jerusalem. Obviously, when we talk about in Bahrain right now, the population of Bahrain is against this humiliation and defeat and subjugation of our people across the region. And that's true of all peoples of the Arab world. Much of them are not able to speak as openly as the people in Bahrain that are steadfast, that are out in the streets almost on a weekly basis, still, decade after the beginning of their rebellion against the Bahraini royal family. They're still coming out condemning this normalization with the Western colonizers on our lands.
Elijah Magnier, security assurances and guarantees have been highlighted as some of the motives behind these deals. Can these Arab countries rely on such promises from the U.S. and from the Israelis, and are these assurances viable in the long term?
Obviously, the Gulf countries, where there is no democracy, are trying to protect their kingdoms by relying on the Americans and trying to be friends with the Israelis, thinking that Israel can support them with the Americans and can protect, can help protecting their regime by offering new intelligence and new technology that can help the Gulf regimes to control and tighten the on citizens. So what we see is, what I understand from all of that, is a very fragile regimes who are trying to get more support from more technological support and more support from Israel, the friend of the United States, to protect this fragile regime, because they don't think the lack of democracy at home can protect them enough, notwithstanding all the decades of ruling over a population that so far accepted the family to succeed one after the other, to pass on the power from father to son. And now, if the United States is talking about democracy and is saying that we are supporting the Gulf regime, this is a very clear contradiction with the principle of democracy in the West. Therefore, this regime can't hold unless they rely on illegal activity, on human rights abuses, on torture, and also learn from the Americans the lack of accountability. That is exactly what the Israelis also are doing and enjoying from whenever they wage war against all the neighboring countries. So I think there is a lot of fear behind that. That's why when we see the intelligence cooperation between the Gulf country and Israel, for what reason these Gulf countries are going to use it but against their own citizens?
Mr. Magnier, I'm going to stay with you for a minute, because our guest in Beirut just mentioned in his previous comments Bahrain as being one of the regional states that normalized its relations with Israel via the Washington-mediated deals back in August 2000. Ever since, the island has been witnessing near-daily protests against the deal, with the protesters believing that such deals open up the way for the Israeli regime's interference in the Persian Gulf region. A lot of opposition from the people of these Gulf countries. Have these governments taken into consideration that these deals and pacts could actually backfire?
I don't think so, because the relationship with Israel is not new, as your guest rightly said. And this relationship goes back a decade with the Emirati, with the Qatar, and with the Bahraini monarchy. Therefore, I don't think the Israelis can offer more than the folkloric handshaking and pictures in front of the world, just to show that Israel is accepted by all these Arab regimes, while the enemy and the demonized country that is completely isolated today is the one that is refusing to accept the reality. So nothing is going to change because the animosity between Iran and Israel is very obvious and it is public. Iran is supporting the axis of the resistance that is creating much more pain to Israel than the outcome and the benefit that is getting from the Arab state for its own security. So the only thing that the Israeli can get from the Gulf country is business deal and more money to be injected in Israel and boost whoever is going to be the prime minister of Israel. On the security level, yes, they can monitor more the communication, they can cause more havoc to these countries and the group that are against the Israeli. They can easily infiltrate, like example, Syria or Lebanon or Iraq, because they are Arabs and their access is more open than the access to the, of the Israelis to these countries. And that will not change because already these countries were working for the Americans on the intelligence service level, and the Americans supporting the Israelis because they are very close allies. So I don't think a lot is going to be manifested out of this memorandum of agreement and the security exchange and support from Israel to Bahrain or the Emiratis or Qatar or the Saudi Arabia.
Laith Madhav, what about the stance that these Gulf countries are presenting to the Palestinians? Do you believe that these Arab governments have turned a blind eye effectively to the suffering of their Arab brethren?
Well, they've turned a blind eye since the beginning. And we're talking about, you know, these monarchies have been installed by the British, you know, crown before they left in the 1960s and 70s. When we talk about Bahrain, this is a ruling family that is not even from Bahrain. Similarly for Qatar, similarly for the United Arab Emirates, they are from Najd, and they were installed as agents to stop any revolutionary movements in the region. Because if you remember the 60s and 50s, and in the whole Arab world was decolonization revolutions, and the British rushed and installed these illegitimate and not indigenous monarchs over these Gulf countries to enforce continuous subjugation of the region and its resources. And so right now, when we look at what is the benefit for the Zionist colony and or the Americans, beyond just the media propaganda benefit for this move, it actually is a negative for the colonial project of Israel, because for 60, 70 years, these countries have been pretending to somehow care for the Palestinian cause, just so not to be a target of revolutionary activities against them in their land. And now they've burned their card, these Gulf monarchs, by stripping down naked in front of the Arab people as agents of destruction of the region on behalf of the Zionist colonists and the imperialists. They are now, you know, open to all attacks. There's nothing anymore that gives them legitimacy to stay.
All right, we're running short of time. One last question for Mr. Magnier. In the wake of these normalization deals, all Palestinian factions have been adamant that they will continue on with their resistance. Do you expect to see a more united Palestinian front in the face of these measures?
If President Mahmoud Abbas is removed from the presidency that he's holding for the last 15, 16 years, I think the Palestinians have shown solidarity against Israel and the will to fight back, to get back their land that has been stolen by the Israelis. Yes, we saw in the Sword of Jerusalem in the last fight how all of Palestine stood as one unity against the Israelis, and not only Jerusalem and Gaza, but that involves all the territory occupied since 1948. Yes, there is more unity among the Palestinians, more unity that is expressed by the Gulf countries with Israel is reflecting on more unity among the Palestinian groups willing to fight Israel and the axis of the resistance to hold on to this cause.
Very well. We're going to leave it there. Allow me to thank my guest, activist and political analyst, Laith Maarouf, joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut, and journalist and political analyst, Elijah Magnier, speaking to us from Brussels. Also, thanks to our viewers for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight. It's good night for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN. Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hussain Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Thank you for joining us here today. Today on The Key, we're going to look at a question. It's kind of interesting, and a lot of people ask this question, and that question is this. Out of curiosity, they ask the question, is it possible for there to have been human beings before Adam and his progeny? Obviously, we know based upon what we're told in religion that Adam was the father of humanity, and we are all children of Adam and Eve, and human beings today are from the progeny of Adam. But the question remains, the question arises, is that was there an Adam, or were there human beings before Adam or not? The answer to this question, obviously, a question is kind of tied up with a certain anthropological findings that, have occurred recently. And maybe it would be good for to analyze this question from that point of view as well. But today, we're going to look at this question from a religious point of view and examine some of the traditions which have been related with respect to this. There are numerous traditions which indicate the fact that there were human beings before Hazrat Adam, before Adam, the father of humanity. Imam Sadiq is reported to have said that you might think that God Almighty has not created a human being other than you. This is wrong, because there were thousands and thousands of Adams people were created, and you are from the progeny of the last of these. This is one tradition which indicates this. Also, Imam Baqir alayhi salam has been reported to have said that God Almighty, from the time that God Almighty created the earth, He created seven worlds in it, and these worlds were never empty of human beings. Progenies came after progenies, and for each one of them, there was a world after a world, until in the end, Adam, the father of humanity, was created, and his progeny, branched off from him. Also, and this is interesting, that a lot of the Mufassirin, a lot of the Quranic commentators have said that one of the reasons why the angels objected to the creation of Adam was possibly because in the earth at that time there were other human beings, or perhaps before this, a while before this, the creation of Adam, there were other beings, similar to human beings, or even human beings, which these angels had seen, and they had witnessed their character and the evils that these human beings had, and because of that, they objected to the creation of Adam. In Surah Baqarah, verse 30, God Almighty relates this, where He says, "Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim." قَالُوا أَتَجْعَلُ فِيهَا مَنْ يُفْسِدُ فِيهَا وَيَسْفِكُ الدِّمَا. The angel said to God, "Will you create or place in it, in the earth, somebody who will corrupt in it, will corrupt it, or will be corrupt in it, and will shed blood?" This is perhaps an indication that they were aware of, and they had seen beings previous to Adam who had done this. Thank you for joining us on The Key. We were looking at the question of whether there were human beings before humanity or not. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussain Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Food and energy prices are soaring across the 19-nation Eurozone, placing enormous pressures on cash-strapped consumers. Inflation hit a record high of 5.1% in January. The matter was debated in the European Parliament on Wednesday.
I'm highly concerned about the combination of high and increasing levels of inflation and a central bank that refuses to normalize its monetary policy.
The story is not the same everywhere. For example, Belgium has an inflation rate of 8%. In France, it's just 2.5%.
Hence, we will see divergence in international competitiveness of the member states of the euro area. We've seen in the past the misery that comes about when you have that kind of development.
The economic impact of COVID-19 has disproportionately hit young adults in the EU. Homelessness and mental health problems are rife. For example, here in Belgium, PreventSuicide.be published a report on Tuesday showing calls to its helpline have skyrocketed. A record 22,000 were made last year, an increase of 20% on the previous year. The vast majority of those desperately reaching out for support are young people. Due to growing public debt, EU governments have been cutting investment in crucial areas such as education.
That cannot be the right way forward. We are increasingly in a knowledge economy in Europe. we need to invest in our people to really be competitive.
The potential fallout from a conflict between Western-backed Ukraine and Russia is fueling economic uncertainty in the EU.
This is something we have to factor into our economic analysis. And geopolitical tensions and issues, of course, have to be recognised.